Welcome to the New Books in Political Science podcast. My name is Heath Brown, and today I'll be talking to Jeffrey Dudas, who is the author of Raised Right, Fatherhood in Modern American Conservatism. The book is published by Stanford University Press, specifically Stanford Law Books. I have the real pleasure to have Jeff on the phone today. Jeff, how are you doing?
Doing great, Heath. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for sharing the book. Thanks for your time today. Why don't you just tell us a little bit about yourself, what your background
is? So I am an associate professor of political science at the University of Connecticut. My PhD was from the University of Washington, also in political science. And I have been at UConn for going on 15 years now.
Great. So this book, so often, books wouldn't be published if they aren't timely in some ways, but there's such interesting ways that this book is timely now, even though it covers a lot of history in it. And for that reason, I thought maybe we could start our conversation by trying to place the book in time. When you refer to modern American conservatism, what is the period that you're most interested in? And why is this the right period to focus on, knowing that these things can be debated? So place us in time in terms of where you did your research and what you think the right catch is.
So when I refer to modern American conservatism, I'm really placing the beginning of the time period at in the early 1950s, in the immediate post-World War II era. And this placement is consistent with what most historians of American conservatism, with the way in which they tend to place a real transition point between kind of an older New Deal era conservatism and earlier, and this kind of this post-war modern conservatism that's really kicked off intellectually by William F. Buckley Jr. and his collaborators on the National Review. And then moving that time period forward, moving that movement forward from about the early 1950s on. It's an appropriate place to start. And as I try to suggest throughout the book, it's the resonances or the through lines between those early moments with Buckley and his collaborators really do carry through up to the contemporary moment.
Now, you describe in the book one of the unifying themes of American conservatism as paternal rights. This isn't what most people would first think of, though I think you make such an interesting, compelling case. What do you mean by this exactly? What do you mean by paternal rights, and why are they so significant? We'll get into some of the chapters and some of the very specific people who you work on, but let's talk sort of from that perspective on paternal rights.
Right. So my abiding interest in getting the project started was in recognizing, along with so many other scholars of American conservatism, that it is on its face such a kind of a motley configuration of interests and constituencies, people who in a lot of ways seem to not have anything at all in common with one another. And yet, in spite of what would appear to be these kinds of significant internal fissures and tensions, the movement has tended to thrive over the course of 70 plus years now. And so I was interested in trying to figure out what it was that these people might share in common. And what I found was they all tend, in spite of their significant differences on matters of policy, on matters of proper governmental relationships with citizens, they all tend to share a very common language, a common way of speaking about the nature of political authority. And what I found is they all tend to voice what I call in the book this paternal rights discourse. And it's in some ways a kind of odd and counterintuitive way of talking that at once conjoins reverence for fathers, both historical fathers and contemporary biological fathers, and reverence for individual rights. And to speak of rights, individual rights, I should say, as really the provenance is really the sort of thing that we were gifted by the work of fathers. And so what I find is that it's this way of thinking and this way of talking and justifying authority that is really widely shared by this otherwise motley group, I should say, of interests and constituents.
As the cover of the book shows, the book is structured around these three important figures, Buckley, Reagan, and Clarence Thomas. And let's start with the chapter about the National Review's William Buckley. Buckley is often referred to as the father of American conservatism, much to the point of the book. But you focus this chapter in part on his fiction writer, the so-called Blackford Oaks novels. Would you tell us about these books that probably for most people are a surprise, if not eye-opening, and what they say about Buckley's worldview and his view of fatherhood?
Sure. So the Blackford Oaks spy novels were a series of 11 novels eventually that Buckley really wrote over the last portion of his life. The first one is entitled Saving the Queen, and it was written predominantly in 1975, so well after Buckley was already a very well-established intellectual and political figure in American politics. And he came eventually to regard this series of spy novels as really one of the crowning achievements of his intellectual product and output. And while I think that you're correct in saying that it's these days a not a very well-known series, it was a surprisingly popular series in its time. One of the reasons I think that it probably is not very well known is that to Buckley's everlasting chagrin, he never could get Hollywood producers and writers interested in converting the novels into movies. So while they, I think, have kind of been lost somewhat in the mists of time, they were quite prominent, at least as literary products in their day, and certainly Buckley always thought of them as great accomplishments. The novels themselves are of varying quality, I suppose. The first couple were both quite well received, both by critics and by a popular audience. Both of the first two novels, in fact, spent significant amounts of time, I should say, on the New York Times bestsellers list and garnered, you know, fairly significantly good reviews. And then as the series went on, it sort of, you know, became less and less commercially and critically attractive. But the novels tell the story of this CIA agent, this covert CIA agent named Blackford Oaks. And Buckley modeled Oaks after his own life experiences. But he also invested Oaks with certainly the physical properties that Buckley himself did not have. So he characterized Oaks consistently as this, quote, startlingly handsome American hero. And he borrows that verbiage from Herman Melville's characterization of Billy Budd. And in fact, Buckley had said he modeled Blackford Oaks in his mind after Robert Redford. And so obviously anybody who's seen the picture of William F. Buckley knows that he bore almost no resemblance to Robert Redford. So physically, it is in fact a significant work of fiction. But with regard to the life experiences of Oaks, it's in many ways a thinly veiled biography of Buckley's own life himself. And so in the book, I spend a long time sort of going through the trajectory of these novels. And what I find is that in spite of the fact that these are fictional novels and they are not obvious commentaries on the politics of the day, as the vast majority of all of his other voluminous writings were, the novels are actually in many ways the most crystalline and the finest and the most clear enunciations of the kind of heroic figure that Buckley considered to be, the modal American subject. And so if you want to understand, my argument is, if you want to understand really the emotional connection that Buckley has to the American nation and to the idea of American citizenship, the best place to go is to these spy novels. And in short, the sort of figure that he celebrates there is this, you know, hyper-masculine figure who engages in dangerous escapades abroad in the name of American security, and who, as a not incidental part of his appeal, has a very strong sex appeal and is consistently engaged in, you know, all manner of sexual liaisons with other dangerous female diplomats, foreign nationals, other spies, and the like. And my argument is that that Oakes's capacities, I suppose, in the bedroom are frequently and always presented, I should say, by Buckley as just as important as the kinds of things that he does in the name of American security.
You move from that, and a figure that features in Buckley's period is Ronald Reagan, and features heavily in the book as well. Reagan rises to fame in politics for taking on student protesters in California, and then later as president, in his actions in the foreign policy realm, especially. How does Reagan fit into your thesis about fatherhood and the political right? He's not writing fiction. He's leading the country. So what is the story about Reagan?
Well, like Buckley Jr. and like Clarence Thomas, Reagan's engagement with fatherhood begins personally and biographically. All three of these figures had fraught, to put it mildly, fraught relationships with their own biological fathers, and yet nevertheless insisted that paternal authority and reverence for fathers was necessary for the production of mature and responsible and disciplined American citizens later in life. And so for Reagan, the desire for strong paternal authority really begins as an attempt, in my argument, to overcome his own the shortcomings of his own biological father, who was a longtime alcoholic and was very unstable and presence, who was someone that Reagan was ashamed of, who Reagan always tried to escape his influence and his shadow. And yet Reagan always still believed that the presence of strong paternal authority and influence was absolutely vital for the conduct of virtuous American citizenship. And so he was consistently looking to replace the lost influence of his own biological father with these kinds of surrogate fathers. Sometimes the surrogate fathers were people in his real life, mentors who he had run across as he sort of worked his way up through the entertainment world into the political world. Sometimes, and eventually, I argue, as he became more entrenched in American politics, the surrogate fathers who were really important to him were the nation's mythical founding fathers, who bequeathed to American citizens this legacy of rights, of individual rights and freedom, and who, according to Reagan, offered a kind of template for how to live virtuous lives. And so for Reagan, whenever he imagined his political rivals or people that he might consider to be political threats or enemies, such as student protesters at Berkeley when he was governor of California in the late 1960s, he tended to interpret their political activism according to this rubric of whether they had been properly parented and turned into virtuous American citizens, or whether they had somehow had a kind of a deficient upbringing, which had led them to behave in ways that were irresponsible, that were ungrateful to their elders. and that were eventually dangerous to the American nation. So for Reagan, the theme of fatherhood is this kind of ever-present theme that articulates both with his own personal biological experience and serves as, I argue, the hinge or the major transition point in his career in politics.
Now, you argue later in the book that Justice Clarence Thomas' view of the Constitution and rights is very much shaped by his view of the home and family. What is this relationship between conservative jurisprudence in sort of the name of Clarence Thomas and the central thesis of your book?
Right. So, you know, for Clarence Thomas, his major jurisprudential philosophy, so the way that he means to read law is in some ways a very conventional one. He employs what's referred to as the original understanding method of reading law, which simply requires the justice or the judge in this case to try to divine whatever the original understanding of the people who wrote the law, who passed the law, who were alive when the law was put into place, what was their understanding of what the law was supposed to do? And then the idea is that the judge acts as a kind of a relay transmitter of that original intention, updating it into modern times or into contemporary times, and then trying to apply that understanding as the meaning of the law. And as I say, this is it's a pretty conventional jurisprudential theory. It's been around for a long time. But it's one that really, for Thomas, makes a lot of sense because it, again, points for him to the role of fathers in determining what it is that the children and sons, or in this case, later generations of jurists, how it is that they ought to understand what law is about and what politics is about. And so for Thomas, when he thinks about the original understanding of a law, or, you know, perhaps the framers of the Constitution, if it's a constitutional case, he's really interpreting those through this other frame that is very important to him about the role that fathers should play in the lives of their children, especially the lives of male children. And for Thomas, the point of fathers is to give children the stability and also to give them or to instill in them the discipline that is needed to make good choices later in life, to learn how to sacrifice, to learn how to be responsible people. And he sees an almost one-to-one convergence between that act of fatherhood and the act of interpreting a legal text. So when you read his most prominent Supreme Court opinions, he is consistently referring to the understandings and the intents of the framers. And his argument is that he has no choice but to enforce that understanding and that intent on the meaning of law, because to do otherwise would be to be unfaithful to his role as a jurist. And it's not a stretch to suggest that to do otherwise than that would also to be unfaithful to one's parentage, unfaithful to the legacy of one's fathers.
Now, your book is not about Donald Trump, but it's very hard to read the book, have read the book, and to hear you talk without thinking about Trump. It's also very hard to think about the what you've said in not in the context of larger questions about gender, but also race. You referenced Trump briefly in the book and some of the comments that he made about former President Obama. And I wonder if maybe we can wrap up a little bit by talking about some of those dimensions of the book, which are not necessarily the focus of the book, but is the context of it, which is our current president. who is not always held up as a model of American conservatism, but does fit into this argument you're making about paternalism and how it relates to issues of gender and also race. So maybe we can wrap up our conversation in the present.
Yeah, as you say, nearly all of the book was written. In fact, all of the book was written prior to the 2016 presidential election. But I do think, as you suggest, that there are clear through lines and connections and tether points between the analysis of the book and the contemporary political moment. And, I do see Donald Trump as a pretty accurate representative of this tradition of modern American conservatism, as I have outlined it, as being really committed and indebted to this vision of paternal authority, as conjoined with a vision of individual rights. And we consistently see in Donald Trump the same sorts of focus on character qualities of both of his the people that he considers to be virtuous Americans, and especially of the people that he considers to be pariahs or villains. It's the same sort of understanding of who counts as a virtuous citizen and who counts as a dangerous citizen that we really see threaded throughout the history of modern American conservatism. There was that moment that I sometimes think back on in one of the presidential debates with Hillary Clinton, where the two candidates had been asked by an audience member to say something nice about each other. I don't know if you remember that exchange. Yes. And I think Hillary went first, and she complimented Donald Trump's children and said that she thought that he must have done something useful. I'm paraphrasing, in raising them, because they seem to have turned out pretty well. And, if you recall, Trump's response was he was quite self-satisfied with that compliment. And it was curious because all of the evidence suggests that Donald Trump was actually a completely non-present figure in his children's lives. And by his own account, he was almost never around and left all of the child rearing to his various wives. But in that moment, you see this connection, literalized on his face and in his body language, of how important he thinks a strong patriarchal figure is to the establishment and to the development eventually of virtuous American citizens.
Yeah, and rises to political fame in part by questioning President Obama's parentage, and so in so many ways, so many other very interesting aspects of this very interesting book. The title again is Raised Right: Fatherhood in American Modern American Conservatism. The author who you've been hearing from is Jeffrey Dudas. The publisher is Stanford University Press, and available at their website. Jeff, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me on, Heath.